Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
It is indeed time for Movies and Booze. Doing showbiz news this week, we have Aisling Bonner doing beer. We have Dean McGuinness and sporting the tattoo of the disembodied head of our latest victim, Olivia Fahey, is here to talk about a couple of movies as well. What's the tattoo you got?
Oh, I got a tattoo of the Rebel Alliance in Star Wars with an inlet of the Jedi Order. So I have, according to one of my friends, I've been officially branded a nerd. I'm like, think of my job title. I am the editor of Geek Ireland. I'm already a nerd.
So, go back. It's the Rebel Alliance, but with a what?
It's the Jedi Order symbol. So it's got the wings with the kind of starry lightsaber in the middle.
Okay. And so does the Rebel Alliance not know? Are there different sorts of Rebel Alliance insignia?
So that symbol is the one that's kind of the most popular one. There was also one that you saw in Star Wars Rebels, the animated series that's on Disney Plus. Brilliant series if nobody has seen it. But that had like more of like a phoenix head. And then this was like the updated version once the kind of, you know, the rebels actually started doing something.
Do you have to have a tattoo to do this segment?
Yes, you do. Sorry.
Okay. We should have warned you in advance.
There's a very nice woman waiting outside with a pair of gloves on for you, Aisling. So we meant to introduce you to her on the way in. Okay, was that your first one?
I got two on the one day, so this is my third. So I already had one and I got two done last week.
Okay. Oh God, so you mean this is like all
you
happening
just doubled
within
it.
A very, very
short... I tripled it in one day.
And what are the other two?
So one is, they're on my leg, so one is a love heart with an airplane. That was my first one. So my mum and I actually got matching tattoos for my 30th, her 70th. Sorry, mum, I've just outed your age. And the new one was actually in honour of my grandmother. So her name was Nana, I called her Nana Peg. And so it's a clothes peg holding onto a heart and it's next to the airplane one.
Oh God.
That's very cute.
Yeah.
Okay. And then Star Wars.
And Star Wars.
And did you? How much thought did you put on which limb you put which relation stroke Star Wars reference?
Honestly, I actually asked, so it was Renato in Voodoo in Glasnevin who did it for me. And I asked him where would the Star Wars one go? And he was just like, put it on your arm. You want to be able to see it? Put it where you can see it. So I was like, there we go.
Okay. Your poor mother and your grandmother were...
that was literally because it was...
You can see that 3 days a year.
Somewhere you can't see.
With the leg, it's like, that was like the squidgier area. So I was kind of like, for the first one, I was like, I want it somewhere where I don't think it's going to hurt so much.
Yeah.
And then ironically, because for the new one, it was a skinnier needle. So it actually hurt more than the arm one did, even though there's more filling in being done on the arm.
Yeah. And so was it sore?
It was a little bit. It's more like for people who haven't gotten a tattoo, it literally feels like someone is just like scratching you with a very sharp nail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Repeatedly for however long it takes. So the leg only took like 5 minutes. The arm took 90.
When are we going to have a drink?
Yeah.
Sorry, I feel woozy talking about this.
Because I remember getting a tattoo and there was a guy getting a big elaborate one on his back. Yeah. And because it's not that sore. But I imagine if someone's at you for 2 hours, he was at the point of,
Renato said he's actually had someone pass out. So he's like, please make sure you've eaten before you come because I don't want anybody to feel like lightheaded or anything like that.
Okay, gosh. Anyway, what are the two movies we're talking about today?
The two movies, we've got two very different films actually. So we're starting off with The Bike Riders, which is the new Tom Hardy, Austin Butler and Jodie Comer film. It is about the Vandals bike rider club in Chicago and kind of just like an insight into how it all started and what it was like sort of living as part of a biker gang sort of thing. And the other one is, you know, taking something completely different. Yeah. It is I Am Celine Dion. And I was kind of talking about it earlier as to how much she opens up in this documentary, and I actually started tearing up because
it's very grim,
it's very intense, and like she doesn't shy away from anything. Yeah. It was an incredible watch, but oh my goodness, I was like bawling my eyes out for 90 minutes.
Oh God, yeah. Oh, Lord. Yeah. And Dean, a beer made with grapes, isn't that like wine?
Yeah, for the first time we're doing a grape ale. First grape ale brewed about 2006, 2007. And the style was first defined in 2021. So it's quite a new style. It is beer. So it is brewed using grains and water and so on. But they blend the unfermented wort with grape must. So it is a...
Grape must.
Effectively, that is the grape juice, including the skins and the pips and all of that. So the crushed grapes to get the grape juice out. So, yeah, you've got, like, as compared to a fruit beer, where they make a beer and then they will add a fruit to it afterwards. You know, they'll add either a fruit syrup or a fruit juice to the beer afterwards. And generally the fruit is an ingredient provided to balance out the flavours with this. This is a true fusion of grape must and beer.
Crikey. And what's the other beer we're talking about?
Well, we're doing compare and contrast. So we've got a grape ale. The original grape ales were Italian grape ales. This is a Belgian grape ale. And then we also have a Retro Creek Lambic. So this is the one, as you regularly wind me up about, where you've got flying cheese going
yes,
over.
Yes, basically, yeah. It's got rubbish in it. That's, that's what it is. Right, so, Aisling, if you're going to make a movie about Rodgers and Hart, the songwriting duo, of course you're going to shoot it in Dublin.
Yeah. Yeah, confusing, question
yeah.
mark.
Yeah.
I was really baffled by this, and I'm afraid to say I still kind of am. So this is a film that is going to star Andrew Scott, Ethan Hawke and Margaret Qualley. It's called Blue Moon. And as you said, it is about, it's more so about Lorenz Hart. I think they called him Larry Hart. And he is from that duo, Rodgers and Hart. And it's kind of about his last days. And it's just been announced that it's going to be shot in Dublin this summer, part of it anyway, which is confusing because,
It's based in New York.
Yeah. And apparently the whole, most of the film itself is going to be set in Sardi's restaurant in New York on one particular night. I think it's the opening night of Oklahoma, the musical Rodgers and Hammerstein, which became the duo after Lorenz Hart passed away.
Yes, right. So maybe they're probably just building a set of that restaurant.
I would imagine that might be the way.
Out in Ardmore.
Some nice little handshake job with the Screen.
Yeah.
Or Screen Ireland or something. I'm not really sure. But yeah, it is going to be filmed in Dublin this summer. And obviously Andrew Scott is the Irish interest there as well.
Right. Is he acting as an Irish person or an American person? Or
I don't think they've actually said who's playing who so far. Obviously Ethan Hawke there is going to be working with director Richard Linklater for the 9th time, I think it is.
So is this like a Richard Linklater film with a story in it, or one of those like goes on for 7 hours
and has been filmed over 12 years? It remains to be seen, but he is known for doing those kind of quirky exploratory things, isn't he?
Yeah.
Although The Hitman that was on Netflix recently, that was actually very surprisingly short and good.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe he's turned a new leaf.
Yeah, maybe so.
Maybe he just needed the money.
That's true.
I'm guessing. Now, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are going to be in a movie together. Is it like since they first came to prominence, they haven't been together since?
No, they have actually. And they've been together in recent times too. So they have this new production company together. It's called Artists Equity. So they obviously worked together, first of all, on Good Will Hunting. And they're teaming up then for a crime thriller called RIP. Going to start filming in the autumn, I believe. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, the second film of their together of their new production company. The first film that they released as part of that was Air, which was the Nike biopic. And that started the two of them as well.
That's true. Yes.
And they were also in The Last Duel together a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And also with that production company that they've made, Artists Equity is making the Small Things Like These film starring Cillian Murphy, that's based off that Claire Keegan book.
Yeah.
Which I'm really excited to see as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Right, so what bit are we going to have first, Dean?
We are tasting the grape ale first.
Okay.
So it originated in Italy. So over the last kind of two decades, there's been a huge growth in craft beer in Italy. And it grew in a country where there was a massive interest in wine. So the fusion of wine and beer seemed to make an amount of sense.
Because you don't associate Italy with craft beer at all.
Yeah, really. It's very much a generational thing. It seems that younger people associate wine with older generations, and they have moved towards craft beer in quite a strong way. There's been a huge growth in craft breweries. A lot of small craft breweries spread all across the country, and a number of them now are really coming to prominence and doing quite well. Now, they developed the style. There was two breweries, Birrificio Monte Giotto Giotto and Verificio Barley, which
it was
is
like we're in Rome there.
They originated the style, and now if you go to Italy, you're kind of almost as likely to see an IPA coming out of an Italian or an IGA coming out of an Italian brewery as you would see an IPA coming out of any other craft brewery.
Yeah,
that, you
yeah.
know, a lot of them are doing it. And then what happened when the style started to become popular there, other wine growing regions with breweries started to do it, and the style has extended a little bit. So it's gone from being Italian grape ale to grape ale, so that it's not restricted to Italian wine varieties. And there are wild or sour grape ales, which is what this beer would fall into. And this is, and I'm putting my neck on the line by saying it's the only Belgian grape ale that I know of that's been called Belgian grape ale, but it might be that some other breweries are starting to do grape ales as well, and doing it as a Belgian grape ale. So the goal with this is that you have the base of a beer, but the goal is that the wine character would balance but predominate. So you should get quite an amount of wine character. They're using four different grape varietals, Solaris and Sigereb, which gives a kind of a fruity floral character. And then Kerner and Pinot Gris, which is the only one that I would recognise a varietal that people would see on the shelves. And that gives a kind of a balancing acidity. Now, what I'm finding with it is there's a certain amount of Sauvignon Blanc character to it coming through.
It's
kind of a gooseberry acidity.
It's very kind of thing.
Now there's layers of flavor in this. There's they're using Nelson Sauvin hops, which give tropical fruit flavors. That's coming through as melon, papaya in the background. There's strawberry, peach as well, sweetness in it. There's balancing flavors coming through. So there's a white pepper spiciness that develops, a certain amount of mint and eucalyptus that comes through in the flavour. Incredibly complex beer, but as I'm describing all of those flavours, it's not a kind of a punch you in the face Imperial Russian stout. You've got a lot of different flavours, but just incredibly refreshing, easy to drink, clean.
Yeah. What's the ABV beer in it?
7.6%.
Whoa!
Fill me up.
Sneaky.
It doesn't taste strong at all.
That's actually very easy drinking. I was even sort of thinking to myself, that could replace the Radlers in my fridge.
I wouldn't be much of a beer drinker now, but that now I'd go any day. I'd take that over a straight beer, which a lot of people will probably straight roll
beer.
Their eyes
this
at.
This is an LGBT beer.
This is a queer beer.
This is one of 2,500 bottles that exist in total.
Oh, my, that's all.
We have 168 in Ireland.
Okay.
So what's the price tag on that?
167.
That's a good point. Very good point.
It's up around the €30 for a bottle. But at the same time, if you're buying, you know, a good bottle of wine, you know, you're going to be paying up around that. So it's for a special beer, it's a nice experience.
No, it is. I don't think I've ever tasted a beer quite like that before. I'm not saying that in a bad kind of, turned up me nose kind of way. Someone says they've just returned from Ostuni in Italy and tried some really good craft beers there. I drank some of that Italian grape wine once. I ended up looking drunker than the guy on the Moretti bottle. Is it just me, or did anyone find that Italian beers, Moretti and Peroni, seem to emerge overnight? We're suddenly in nearly every pub in the country. I don't know.
Moretti is Heineken owned, so...
Definitely think Moretti took over out of nowhere. I think it was last summer or the summer before.
During lockdown was my first, when they were doing the takeaway pints. I remember that was my first Moretti, and I was like, I've never heard of this brand before.
You thought you were so alt.
Yeah, I was just like, ooh, something fancy. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't that fancy at all. I'm in my 60s, and when I started drinking 50 years ago, so you started drinking when you were 10, good man. When I started drinking 50 years ago, I was always told never mix the barley and the grape, so that beer doesn't make sense. Well, it's just part of the continuing evolution where, you know, beer and wine are sort of getting closer to each other. We are going to change the name of this spot to movies and it's all the feckin' same, really. somebody wants to know is that somebody's compared that the bike riders is like Goodfellas and Harleys. Is that a fair comparison?
Oh, that's actually a very good sentence that I'm totally going to steal.
Okay, you will be hearing that sentence again just after this commercial break.
But you're the man in charge. I'm Sonny. I was hoping maybe to little food, a little drink. Camp out for a night or two. Want to show a little class, contribute to the party.
Help yourself. This here's Brucey. It's Benny right there with the boot. And I'm Johnny. We're the Vandal.
Well, it's nice to meet some proper.
Right, that's Bike Riders. Mm-hmm. So it's set in the 1960s?
Set in the 1960s, and it's how this very well-known biker gang kind of came to be. And it all started off with this guy, Johnny. He wanted to kind of just basically get a group of people together like that were like-minded into their bikes. And then it's kind of like how the gang kind of became a bit more, shall we say, violent and deadly as the years went on. So it's set during a 10-year period, and it's based on a book called The Bike Riders as well. And actually in the film, you have someone playing, it's the guy from Challengers, whose name just escapes me at this moment. Maybe someone will text in with his name, but he plays the author and he's like interviewing everybody. And it's he's interviewing Jodie Comer's character, she is sort of telling the stories back. He was also there during some of the moments, and then he goes off and comes back, and then she's filling in the blanks for him kind of thing. So it's actually a really interesting way that they've told the story. And at first I was kind of like, I'm not sure how well this is going to go down, because actually this premiered at one of the film festivals last August, and it was supposed to come out in December with 20th Century. And then suddenly it was taken off the roster, off the schedule, and wasn't given a new date. So everyone's kind of like, well, what's going on? It ended up getting shopped around and Universal picked it up. So then it's now being released through Universal. So I was kind of going into this being like, well, do you know what? If it was getting kind of removed from one group and it's now being put to another, like this may not bode well for the film itself. Nope, genuinely really enjoyed it. And it's kind of like a film about nothing, but a film about something. So there is like a storyline, and it's actually really interesting to sort of see the kind of dynamics within the group and how they've changed over time. But also, like, if you were to ask me, like, specifically, like, if there was any, like, standout moments, it wasn't really one of those films. Mm. It's just kind of like, it has a very nice storytelling pattern. And then you're kind of like, oh, great, I've learned something from that.
Okay, so they're a biker group. Are they going anywhere? Or did they just hang around in one place and go for schwins occasionally? Or
pretty much that. They've got, like, this clubhouse. It's actually a bar. And that's kind of where a lot of, like, their meetings and things take place. And then they would often go out and they'd host picnics, which is, like, a load of the gangs from local areas would sort of get together.
That sounds very wholesome.
It sounds much more wholesome than it actually is. Like, 9 times out of 10, there's a couple of fist fights going on. Okay.
There's no checkered claw.
Okay, so these are drug picnics is what they're having.
Well, not with the Vandals initially, but it's kind of like, as you know, as Johnny kind of left and other people kind of took over, that's kind of where the drug smuggling and the murders and things like that kind of come in. But what I thought was interesting is that even though Johnny was trying to keep it kind of wholesome to a certain extent, like I use wholesome with like quotations there, but he would also be like, if anybody was trying to challenge him to be the leader of the gang, he would always go, okay, fists or knives. Oof. And I'm like, what? That's not very wholesome now, is
it's
it?
It's not really, no. Well, what did he expect then, if he was setting that kind of an example?
Exactly,
for people,
exactly.
So, I mean, so Johnny, I assume, is Austin Butler, is it?
Actually, no, that's Tom Hardy. Austin Butler is playing Benny, who's kind of this like younger, kind of like almost like Johnny's protege. And he ends up marrying Carol, who is Jodie Comer's character.
Okay.
And she kind of sees how Benny is a bit of a loose cannon. And she's like, I can change him, you know, as they often say. And I have to say, like, Austin Butler went into this straight after filming Dune. And that's one of the reasons why he wasn't able to shave his head or his eyebrows off for the role in Dune. He had to wear, like, a cap for that.
Oh, right.
So he went straight into that. And actually, Benny does have quite kind of, like, spontaneous bursts of violence as well. So it was kind of interesting that he went from sort of to one maniac to another in a way.
Has he gotten rid of the Elvis accent?
Yes.
Okay,
like,
good.
It's a bit, it was kind of nearly creeping in some parts,
but
because of the character, it actually kind of suited. And I have to say, whoever lit like one of his opening scenes where he's just like leaning over the pool table, bravo, that man, like you could just see every corner of his face and every muscle on his arms. And I was trying not to get distracted.
John Mayo says that the line "Goodfellas on Harleys" is a line from the ad for the movie.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. So somebody has coined it already.
Oh, there we go.
You can't take that.
I can't hijack it then.
Yeah.
Oh well.
So what would be the similarity between this and Goodfellas?
I suppose it's kind of like that brotherhood togetherness. So like with Goodfellas, like they were always kind of like, it's us against everybody else until, well, now you've kind of annoyed us and now you're out.
Mm.
And that is kind of nearly, not exactly the same as what happens in Bike Riders, but there's a few definite similarities in that sense. So the minute I heard that, I was like, that's actually a very good way to describe it.
Yeah. And it, given it's set in the 1960s, do you get a sense of what, you know, what's going on in the wider world or what's going on in the United States even in a way? Because it's this time of great ferment and all the rest of it. Are they just going on picnics, not bothering a damn about anything else going on?
Exactly. It's all about the club. It's all about what their lives are and, you know, to hell with everybody else.
Someone says, sounds like bikers are as boring and fake exciting in movies as they are in real life.
Hopefully you're not going to be wearing your colours in a bar anytime soon. Yeah.
So, because what was the point of setting up the thing in the first place? What was his vision for it?
Just like for a community, like, yeah, and friendship and bonding and things like that. And like, you can kind of see where he was sort of coming from with it. And especially at that time, like he apparently was a dirt bike rider first and then became more like the Harley sort of style.
Mm.
But yeah, the way that it kind of changed and the dynamics within the groups, it is actually just like a very fascinating, almost like an anthropology study kind of thing.
Okay. And those characters, are they based on real people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
They're based on real people. So it is loosely based on the book, but a lot of the characters, and they actually, it's really cute at the end they show, because the author is like often taking pictures of all of them during the, when he's like recording and chatting to them and things like that. And they actually show the real pictures that he took at the end. So you can kind of see exactly how like they match them up. But I thought that was a really, really nice touch.
Oh yeah, I love that. Actually.
Yeah, me too.
I love writing at the end of movies as well, when they tell you what happened to them afterwards.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it just end and you're like, but what happened
now? Yeah. What are they now? And how's Jodie Comer's American accent?
Actually, very good. It's very strong. And I think because of the character she was playing and because of the area that Carol was growing up in, like, it's very strong Chicago. But, you know, she naturally has a very strong Liverpudlian accent. Yeah. So I can kind of see where the correlation would come there, that she would just go for it.
She's and so good at accents. Like,
she really is,
Eve,
yeah.
She does a whole load of them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I thought it was, all in all, very surprising, very good, and, you know, solid 4 stars.
Yeah, because someone says movies are ruined by bad American accents by British and Irish actors, but Americans never complain too much. When it's the other way around, we lose the plot. Yeah, I wonder, do they notice even?
Sometimes. Like, I know my cousin is in Atlanta, and he met Andrew Lincoln when he was in the height of The Walking Dead. And it was only when he started talking to him in his British accent that he kind of went, oh, I knew there was something kind of off with your like Georgian accent. Yeah. But now that I hear you're British, it makes perfect sense. But even though he didn't know that he wasn't naturally American, he was like, I knew that there was something slightly off about it.
Mm, that's interesting.
When Hugh Laurie was doing House, one of the producers said, you know, it's great that we've got an authentic American guy doing this role, because I'm really pissed off with all of the Europeans coming over and taking our roles.
God, his American accent wasn't that great, I thought, really. It was a very kind of generic accent.
I think it's because he stayed in it all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're going to mix beer and wine, remember the rhyme, wine and beer, you won't see clear. Beer and wine, you'll be fine. Yeah. Challenge accepted. the Thursday Murder Club, I think we were talking about this. Pretty much every actor in Britain is now signed up to take part in this.
Yeah, essentially. And they keep drip feeding more and more people. It's kind of marketing genius. So the latest person to be added to the cast is former Doctor Who, David Tennant. So he's going to join Jonathan Pryce, Pierce Brosnan, going to play one of the leads. Helen Mirren is in there. Ben Kingsley, Celia Imrie. It's an amazing cast. And as I said, they just keep drip feeding more and more people. Naomi Ackie was also added to the list this week. She was Whitney Houston in the most recent Whitney Houston biopic, I Want to Dance with Somebody. But I'm so excited to see this film. It's going to be out on Netflix. They're filming, I think starting filming this month until September. So we don't know yet when it's going to be out. But I'm sure they'll add a few more stars before the release date.
Because it's a very British kind of thing.
Very much so.
And the books are kind of, you wouldn't call them exciting, really. It's kind of comforting, really.
Yeah.
And it's not like, oh, I was surprised by that outcome. Yeah, even like,
totally.
The headline or the title of one of the books is called The Bullet That Missed.
Yeah.
And you go, that's what happens in the end. You know.
Exactly.
You actually give away the end right at the start.
The man who died twice, you're like sitting there waiting for the second time. But there's something about the way they're written.
And they're kind of comforting.
They are.
Everyone's nice.
Do you know what? They're the they're the oh my god, what a complete Ashlings of older Britain, I think.
Fair enough. Yeah. And it's for and it's nice to see work with, you know, for pensioners in it doing
absolutely stuff. Yeah, it's good to have like older people as the stars.
So why did they cancel the movie, the premiere of a movie written by ChatGPT? I would be fascinated to see that.
I agree.
I assume because it would be so bad.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. So there's all sorts of drama surrounding this film. A Swiss filmmaker made it, and it's called The Last Screenwriter. And essentially, it is about a screenwriter who discovers AI and ChatGPT and is like blown away by the technology and what it can do, and decides to write a film about it. But basically, the director says that the whole point of the film is to start a conversation about AI and the dangers it could bring to creativity and the film industry specifically. But now, just this week, in fact, yesterday, I think, a cinema in London that was due to hold the premiere has pulled the film entirely because of backlash and people saying exactly what the film is trying to tell you, that AI is bad for the industry. But the director is saying, hang on, this is the whole point.
Point of it,
and if you actually went and watched the film, you would see that I'm on your side and this is what I'm trying to say. But apparently they posted that they were showing the film and they got so much complaints, 200 complaints or something on Instagram, and then they pulled it. And they're the only...
From, yes, Russian bots are outraged by
but
this.
This is a point, yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was due to be on Sunday, and now instead of being like the worldwide premiere, it's just going to be a screening for the cast and crew, of which I think there was one character.
Oh, God, there was only...
There was one fella named in the cast list anyway, this screenplay writer.
It probably wasn't big budget anyway.
No, I don't think so.
One actor in his computer.
Yeah, and it is quite funny because literally in it, like credited is ChatGPT 4.0 by OpenAI.
Oh, my God.
It's written the whole thing.
And the Oscar goes to.
Yeah.
Right. Our next beer.
We are on to, so we have Timmermans Retro Creek Lambic. So with lambic beers, they're brewed by spontaneous fermentation. So the wort is made, the grains are mixed with water and you get a sugary liquid, and it's put into what's called a coolship, which is a wide, long container that's quite shallow. They open a window on one side of the brewery, open a window on the other, get an airflow going through while yeast settles into the beer and it spontaneously ferments. And you end up with some quite unusual flavours as a result. Mm. Now with lambics, when you have a lambic, they can't directly control it because by nature
so they don't really know exactly what they're going to end up with.
No, they know that it will go in a certain direction, and lambics should and are, if you're following the convention, all brewed in the Brussels area and in the area just south of Brussels. And the logic of that is that the organisms that are in the air naturally there are suited to the brewing of lambics. If a lambic is brewed anywhere else in the world, it should be called lambic style, but that's not a requirement. So when they get something that's particularly acidic, often what they'll do is they'll blend it, and then you get what's called a goose lambic. Another thing that they can do is blend the beer with a fruit juice or a fruit syrup. So, and that's when you get fruit lambics. So you have an amount of acidity and then an amount of sweetness brought into the beer. Very, very low bitterness. They use old hops. They age the hops, wait for the hops actually to go beyond a state where any normal brewer would use them, because they want to use large quantities of hops for the preservative value, but they don't want any bitterness coming into the beer. The balance in the beer is coming from the acidity. So really simple beer to describe. It's a cherry lambic and it tastes of... cherries.
Yes. Surprisingly, yes.
But to develop that a little bit more, the pits in cherries can give a slightly almond flavour. So with that, if you have an idea of a Bakewell tart in your head, that combines almond and pastry and cherries, you can get a kind of an amount of that coming through. But the difference between this and the grape ale, the grape ale is like having a beer, pouring it into a casserole and cooking the casserole. The creek is like making some applesauce and putting it with your pork.
Yeah.
That, you know, in one case, it's completely integrated into the thing itself. In the other, It's a balancing of two different flavours.
Yes, yeah. Because you can get the bit of fruit, but you can get the bit of bitterness, definitely. Mm. And I suppose it's up to them to try and keep those things.
Said, I need to throttle you. You do this to me every time. It's not bitterness, it's acidity.
Okay. You're sounding like mean. Okay, yeah.
The way that you get it, if you take a mouthful of it and let it go over the sides of your tongue, yeah, and you start, your mouth starts watering like crazy, that's acidity. If you get it at the back of your tongue, that's bitterness.
Okay.
So, how geeky am I?
Yeah, I know, sorry. I'd like to apologise on behalf of News Talk and Bauer and the Bauer Media Group International for getting acidity wrong. Somebody wants to know what would happen if one of your Movies and Booze cast actually answered the cash machine call, or can they enter? You'd think not. It might look a bit dodge if they did actually enter there. Every time we have an outside broadcast and when they start doing, it's time to see who, like every single person, or at least... There's always a guy, and it's always a dad, takes a phone out and goes, oh, I have a call! You know, every single time. Now, we'll move on to our second movie. It is I Am Celine Dion. Here's a clip.
I've been diagnosed with a very rare neurological disorder, and I wasn't ready to say anything before. But I'm ready now. There were nights when the wind was so cold. I see my life, and I love every piece of it. When a girl loves her shoes, she always make them fit. From 6 to 10, give it to me. I love them. Here we go. I finished crying in the instant, actually. And you record. It sounds great, but when you go on stage, it will be greater. I think we did create our own magic. There were days when the sun was so cool. It's not hard to do a show, you know. It's hard to cancel a show.
Okay, that's I Am Celine Dion. I don't get the shoes reference.
So that scene is from, she has this absolutely massive warehouse and it's full of all of her clothes from performing, from any of like the premieres that she's gone to, the Met Galas, like that's where all of these things are. And oh my goodness, do I want to go and play in there? She picks up this pair of shoes and like they're clearly from like decades ago. And she goes, oh, these look like the Dior shoes. It takes out the piece of paper on the inside and goes, yes, these are Dior. Ha ha, you never forget a woman in her shoes. And then she was saying that if she just saw a pair that she really, really liked, she would just literally be like, I don't care what size you have, but like, I will just make them work. Like whatever size is available, I will make it work.
Right,
and there was one time when she was like, I squeezed my feet into shoes that were three sizes too small. So my toes were bent in under my foot. I was like, how could you even walk in that?
It was a kind of random clip to choose for the, I think that was from the trailer.
It's from the trailer,
it?
Yeah.
Without context, it's a bit weird.
Yeah, it is a strange one. But I mean, ultimately, is as you said, you were, you know, balling.
Yeah, like so that was one of the, like it's definitely a tale of, like there is humour and love and family in there, but then there is also the absolute horror of what it is that she's actually going through. So they're very clever in how they do it in that, at the very beginning, you do get a short glimpse as to just how bad it is. It's not very detailed. It's kind of nearly like from afar, like you're looking in through a window. But then towards the end of the documentary, it's only about 90 minutes long. And then you get the full force of exactly what it is that she's going through. It lasts for nearly like 15 minutes as well. Like it was a long stint of watching someone in absolute agony. And they even had like close-ups of like how her face was contorting with it. So with stiff person syndrome, essentially what happens is that her muscles are trying to fight against what the body actually wants it to do. So if the nerves are like overly stimulated, then the muscles will just sort of go rigid and they just won't do exactly what it is that you want to do. So after she's been trying to get back into the studio, trying to get back singing, because of course your vocal cords are they're a muscle in there as well. So she hasn't been able to sing properly in 2 years. And so she's been trying to like train and get back into it and do what she can to get back out on stage, because that's what she loves. And she loves being like performing in front of people and seeing the love from the crowd and things like that. So she goes in and has a recording session, and it takes her a couple of goes, a bit more, but like she gets there and she's like really, really happy. And then afterwards, when she's having like a physio session, she just completely seizes it up. So she's actually face down on the massage table and just goes, and he's just like, okay, like, I need help. Like, Celine's having an episode, I think is how he referred to it as. And it took like a number of people to try and get her on her side. And they're like putting nasal spray up her nose to make sure that her airways are still clear so she can breathe. Her jaw is clenched. Her eyes are nearly rolling back in her head. Like, it is a tough, tough watch. But oh my God, how important is it to try and like highlight exactly what it is that she is experiencing? Because at one point she even says, I feel like I'm almost trapped in my house because, God forbid, if someone who had bought tickets to one of my shows that I had to cancel sees me out and about having dinner with my children, they'd be kind of like, well, hang on a minute. Like, if you can do this, like, how come you can't get out on stage? She goes, yeah. And they're right, because I owe my career to them. I owe my life to them. Aww. So, like, I'm nearly housebound, not just because of my condition, but also because I don't want to, like, let anybody down. And like, you can see just how much like love and adoration that she has for her fans, for her family and everything. But that actually broke my heart, because I was like, you should be able to go out and have dinner with your family if you feel physically able to do that. Yeah. But the kicker is that they said that the reason why she had such a bad episode after being in the studio is because her brain was so overly stimulated with joy and happiness that it basically then filtered through the body. So then her reaction was, so hang on a minute, like, if I'm just so happy that this is going to happen to me? And they were kind of like, maybe, because of course there's so much unknown about it as well.
And is there any indication of what the prognosis is for her with this?
From the research that I looked into, it's not something that can be cured. Like, this is something that's been getting progressively worse and worse for her over the years. And there's even segments where they kind of show, like, she's talking about the little tricks that she used to do to try and hide the fact that she was struggling, and that like if she was like not able to sing a certain note, she'd put the microphone out to the crowd so the crowd would sing it for her. Or sometimes if there was like technical difficulties, and she jokes that when she was a kid and she was singing and a guy was playing a guitar and kept hitting a few bum notes, and she'd turn around to him to be just like, you're doing it wrong. And her mother was like, don't ever let them see that something is going wrong. Always carry on with the show. And so she took that with her to when she started struggling on stage. So she would never, she'd be like, if the microphone, if she hit a bum note or something like that, she'd be like tapping the microphone to be like, oh, there's something wrong with the microphone, or there's a technical difficulty, or there was always something that she'd kind of come up with. And looking back, because they did show a few examples, and you're like, oh, I get it. Like, you can kind of see it now in hindsight.
She's very honest.
Honest, and that's something that she said. She was like, I hate lying. So this is why she wanted to do this, and she wanted to bring people into her home. And it's actually very cute at the beginning that you even see like the documentary team are like showing her twin sons how to use the camera and like do the focus and the lighting and things like that for her. So it was a completely like world enveloped kind of experience, not only for her but for them also, and then also for the viewers. So as much as like I'm saying, like, I was sobbing throughout that, but it was also like really spectacular. I think I went into it expecting something like the Michael J. Fox Still documentary. This, I think, has taken that to another level with just how open she was with what's going on in her life.
Oh, my word. Finally, I didn't know they were making Yellowstone anymore. I thought they'd finished after series 5 or 6 or whatever amount there is there. But Kevin Costner's going to leave it.
Yeah.
Or says he is.
It's a bit of a disaster by the sounds of things. So they're currently in the middle of the 5th and final season, but they've been in the middle of the 5th and final season for years.
Eight
of the 14 episodes have aired, but they haven't aired since 2022. It was kind of a mixture of the Hollywood strike, and there's all this stuff in the background with pay issues, and Kevin Costner has said, I'm outie, I'm done. And I don't know, I can't tell yet whether he has filmed the remaining episodes or not, or if he's just ditching mid season. But I mean, it's been 2 years since the first part of the season has aired. So I would imagine they haven't even started filming the second half.
But he has said he's bitching because they offered him less money than he wanted.
He's moaning, So he actually claimed a while back that he signed a contract for season 6 and 7, but then that they were offering him less money than the previous season. So that all fell apart. He also claims that he's still owed $12 million from the first part of the 5th season. That's the one that's currently up in the air. So yeah, he's just announced on Instagram that he's out, and the fans are devastated. But look, could they not see it coming?
I thought 5 seasons would be good to get out of him.
There's a load of spin-offs of it as well. They'll be grand.
I know they will be grand. I mean, it's total nonsense, the season, or the whole series. Have you ever watched Yellowstone?
I haven't.
Just total nonsense. No, it's not. It's like
Very America,
it's
isn't
Dallas.
It?
Yeah. You know, it's cardboard thin, and you know, the women, basically all the female characters have to take their clothes off at least twice an episode. Amazing. You know, that seems to be in their contract.
Cool.
Kevin Costner,
he
doesn't have to.
Yeah.
But he's invested all his own money into his cowboy movies that he's making now, so that won't go badly at all, one assumes.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, he's all gung-ho on this Western series that he's focusing on.
So. Aisling, Olivia and Dean, thank you all very much.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.